You're listening to a Radio 1 91 FM podcast.
On the line, coming to us live from Tamaki Makaurau, we have Matariki Bennett coming through to have a chat about their new poetry book, E Kō Nō Hiakoe. Good morning to you. How are you doing?
Morena, I'm well, thank you. How are you?
Nice. Very, very well, thank you. Dunedin's weather has been very summery as of late, and it's scary because it's meant to be, you know, frigid and cold. So it's good to have it come back to its natural cycle. How is it visiting your hometown?
Yeah, it's been so special, and to have all of my friends and family around at this very big time for me has been really beautiful and special.
Because you've got the book launch quite soon, right?
I just had the book launch
just
on Wednesday.
It. Nice.
At, my cousin Tim Melville's gallery in Tamaki, and just, the most special night. It was so beautiful.
Nice, man. That's awesome. That's awesome. Very, very happy for you. I want to start talking about this this book here, because when I started reading a bunch of the different poems, it reminded me of a song by Princess Nokia, which is called ABCs of New York. And in a similar way to how New York plays out in that track, I think Auckland plays a pivotal role in this book, whether it's mention of Grey Lynn being swallowed by the dawn or the Avondale spider being in your molars. You know, this book is many things, but among them, you know, would you consider it a confession of adoration for your hometown?
I think the whole book is kind of an exploration of identity and what makes up identity. For a lot of people, it's places. And there are so many places within Tamaki Makaurau that held me through my really formative years. And so it's kind of it's a goodbye, I guess, to those places, and it's a goodbye to those times, kind of, and now in my stage of life, having moved away, but also a reflection on them. And how they shaped me.
Because these poems that were in here are a couple of years old, right?
The bones of some of them are from when I was 14. But reworked with my perspective now. And then some of them I wrote like a month before publishing. So there's really new, and then there's,
A good spread, you could say. At the beginning of most of this, like the chapters, I can see, or like sections in this book, there are really gorgeous art pieces welcoming the reader into the first poem of each section. Are they meant to serve as a visual reference for what the reader is going to digest? And I wonder, how did you choose those art pieces?
Starting with the cover, my mum painted the cover.
Oh, wow.
It's a series of paintings called the Motherline paintings, and I think there's kind of lines across the cover, and those are the lines in our palms, and so it's talking about our Motherline.
Oh, wow.
And then inside, all the paintings within the book have been done by my sister, Mahina Bennett, and she started painting when I first started writing, so there weren't actually really any poems for her to go off. But in my research phase, I made mood boards and I made playlists. That was the big thing, was I made a playlist for each collection when I had kind of like begun thinking about what I wanted to write in each section. And so she started painting as I started writing, and that kind of grew together. It was very much a collaborative thing. I don't get art and she doesn't get poetry, but
I don't get either. Somehow
they've worked really well together.
Nice. That's fantastic. Yeah, I think they fit real well, and it's awesome that they have a genealogy aspect to it, that it's your flesh and blood doing these things. Is your whole family quite artsy?
Yeah, I couldn't get away from it. The other night someone said to mum and dad that, you could have had a lawyer, you could have had a doctor, you could have had anything, but you've got a family of artists, so.
Yeah. Brooke, no. it didn't take me very long to see a certain repetition of a few words, and these words are like star, sun, and moon, and I think that's pretty, on the nose, considering your name is Matariki, and it seems like those astral bodies are very near and dear to your heart. Did that connection with the great astral bodies, come from you being named that? Was your family very stargazy? Like, where did your love for these planetary things come from?
I totally think it's my name. I've always been really interested in everything outside of the earth and how big everything is and how small we are. I remember being a kid and across different times, like in summer, I remember going up north and Dad and me and my siblings lying and stargazing and pretending that we could see Matariki even though it was summer. And then in the winter, like climbing up Maunga Fo and trying to look for Matariki through the light pollution and kind of like, yeah, I think I've always had like a real yearning for being able to see the full night sky growing up in central Auckland where it's, you know, there's so much light pollution. So, yeah, I guess it's kind of reflective of that, of what could be, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I share your love for those, you know, outer space, but I don't know. Sometimes for me it's like, if I'm happy, I'll think of like the Pale Blue Dot speech by Carl Sagan, or if I'm real sad, I'll just think about how the, you know, heat death, everything's gonna die in like a trillion years. But yeah, do you go through those motions of processing space?
Yeah, I mean, my grandma and I, who my grandma's a real strong thread in the book.
She is.
We have conversations all the time about stars.
Mm.
And, I mean, I'm not a scientist by any means, don't understand behind any of it, but it is all wonder and it's kind of really nice, you know, for us both to kind of sit there and wonder about it, but not actually know anything about it, you know, and I think it allows for us to be hopeful.
Mm.
You know, I think if we knew too much about anything,
it'll lose its magic a little bit, you know.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah.
The beauty of the great unknown, so to speak. Now, I'm an appreciator of good prose, and I think you definitely have a way with words on this thing. And the following three lines I'm about to say are from Rothmans and Rockstars. Bumping K from the arms of sunglasses, shivering in the wash house, chopped cones and nihilism. Now, that really struck me as, I think, unfortunately, and this is a little bit of a dark topic, but drugs do seem to be coming a more and more of a future for young people who don't see one and haven't really been offered one by our political system or our economy. Do you think that you were at danger of joining that club?
I think that I walked a pretty fine line for a while.
Mm.
I'm in such a privileged position and I will not forget that, you know, my access to mental health support and just from the position my parents are in, that a lot of my friends didn't have. And so they're continuing to struggle with these things. And it is scary. It is scary that, you know, we can get caught in these cycles. And, you know, for some of us, I mean, for me, it was a fleeting time in my life, but for some people it is their life and it will continue to be their life. So I kind of wanted to shine light on that. And I really didn't want it to be kind of a, you know, privileged, like, but like it is the true reality for a lot of people that I have grown up around and my closest friends, you know, the real harshness of it all.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's part of you, and any good writer writes what they know about, and you know about that.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think that's a really good perspective to have in there. I really like the poem, hashtag activism is oversaturated with your photo dumps because you felt weird about posting a selfie during a revolution. In that poem, you write that the only thing keeping us together is going 22s on the ciggy and knowing the expiry date on being young and outspoken. When is that expiration date, do you think?
Yeah, well, I wonder if I've hit it. No, I remember when I was, I mean, me and all my friends, we are all poets, and we kind of had this big boom. My closest friends in this collective called Ngahi Nepu Kōrero, we had this big boom in 2020, so we would have all been 17 at the time. We were really gaining traction, and we were being very political and outspoken, and there was this shifting point, and I can't pinpoint exactly what it was that caused the shift. But it was like people were suddenly like, I think we were just old enough for people to kind of treat us as adults, you know, and no longer we don't have these like really young, fiery. And I think maybe us growing up as well and kind of being more aware of what we're saying and not so fearless. So yeah, and I think, I mean, I don't know. I don't want that. I don't want people to lose hope about being political, because it's really important for us to speak up at all times. I mean, I've written this book, which is political, but yeah.
I think you know, young is a mindset, so to speak, yeah. Not in a creepy way, in the sense that, like, you know, it's like, you know, I know so many people who might be in their 30s or 40s and have just become wankers, you know, and just become like, you know, whatever. They care more about their property or their money rather than helping people or, you know, investigating themselves and so on and so forth. So I think the expiration date on being young is pretty fluid, but I get what you're saying. Like, there is a youthful spark that and kind of rage that might quieten down. But is that a bad thing?
I don't think it's a bad thing that you kind of have this bit that where you kind of are exploding and then, you know, you kind of calm down a little bit, because the next generation, I mean, knowing that the next generation below you is going to pick that up. Mm. But I also just think that there's a really, what I've experienced anyway, is there's a really interesting way you're perceived by kind of the media and the world when you're young and when you have a lot to say. I think it's more, I mean, I don't know, but I feel like it's a little bit more palatable, maybe, or a little bit, you're kind of listened to a little bit more, because it's, yeah, I don't know, but I could be wrong about that. But yeah, I think my reflections in this poem were kind of like, we had this really small time period where we were really, really, really kind of gaining traction and talking about things that made us really fiery, and then some spark was lost. And I think maybe it could have been social media backlash. I mean, there was a lot of cruel people online who, you know, punched down.
Man, the internet is such a interesting place, and I kind of want to touch on the internet a little bit, because the last line of that poem, hashtag activism, is so on and so forth. The last line of that poem is, I feel like my silence might be the best part of me. Now, I know in the context of this, it's self-deprecating, and the whole book is you not realizing that, but realizing your silence isn't actually that nice. But I think that, you know, in a world where we're all being corralled into being audience and performer, and and to be content machines with hot takes to, you know, create profits for big data, you know, I think that tact certainly becomes a skill, you know.
Totally. You've totally nailed the kind of double meaning, I guess, behind that. But I think on that same vein of, you know, when you're really young and outspoken and fearless, you kind of don't understand that you don't need to have an opinion on everything. Yep. And I think that's something I learned really quickly, was I was being asked, you know, at 16 about things I had no idea about, and I was, you know, being perceived as somebody who had all these radical ideas about, you know, feminism and stuff, which I, at the time, I mean, me and the girls, we were writing about things that had feminist undertones, but they were a lot more about Maori history, you know. And it was like, oh, they see a group of young women, okay, they clearly must be talking about feminism. And we, you know, present ourselves, you know, very I guess alternative, or, you know, a little bit creative. And so, you know, it was, oh, these young women speak about sexuality and all of that stuff. And it was like, no, we actually don't, at that time, you know, we're exploring who we are, and we don't actually know who we are, and we don't know everything about everything, and we can't speak for everything. So it was really, I mean, it was difficult, because I was learning at the time with quite a kind of making my mistakes pretty publicly. But, you know, learned that it is really important to be picky with who you share things with and what you share with people and how you utilize your platform and how you utilize your voice. And you don't need to talk about everything that you don't know about. And you know, if you don't know about something, utilize your platform to amplify the voices of those who actually do know about what you're talking about, you know?
Totally. No, everyone's guilty of it, speaking on topics they're not familiar with. But I think that what you were talking about there with being young and being assumed to have all these positions is, you know, it's annoying, because we have this expectation of of young people to be talking about these things, but also we don't give them an arts education or a civic education. So, like, it's not really, it's just left up to the internet, and that's filled with, like, you know, Andrew Tate's and BuzzFeed. So, well, you know, there's not much nuance there, you know? It's very infuriating. I want to touch on one more poem. The poem "What Am I to a Star?" From the ones I read, it's much more narrative and dialogue heavy than the other ones, and it features epistemology, which is a topic I really like. You know, how do we know that we know things, and how do we know them without even understanding them? And I think the example you used in this was like iPhones and a few other things, and obviously big things in space. Have you had any of those moments recently where you're like, man, I trust this thing so much despite not even knowing how it works?
Well, I mean, not to get into the big conversation about this. I mean, I touch on it a little bit in here, but AI. Not that I use AI, because that just is terrifying. Like, you know, it is so scary to me. But, you know, all of technology, all of that realm of things just makes zero sense to me. I have the opposite of a practical brain. I don't understand much. AI for me at the moment is the big what is that? And where is it going?
I know, it's so weird, it's so opaque, and it's so destructive, and everyone can't get enough of it. It's the annoying thing. It's just it's really frustrating. And it must be annoying as a filmmaker seeing all the I don't know, maybe the future of film is gonna be AI driven.
Well, no, I don't believe it.
You don't believe that? That's good. Okay, good. I'm glad you have fun.
I think there's something special that humans have that, I mean, who knows, but I think for now, I think we're safe.
I want to thank you so much for your time and coming on the program today. It's been a real pleasure having you and talking about this new book, which I highly recommend our listeners go buy a copy, and they can do so from lamplightbooks.co.nz. Do you have any final words for our lovely listeners today, Matariki?
No, just thank you so much for having me and talking with me, and please read the book. I hope that there's something in there for each and every one of you.
I'm sure there is. It's a real variety show is what I feel. That was Matariki Bennett coming on the program today talking about a new poetry book, E Ko Nō Hiakoe. You're listening to The One. We don't even...
That was a Radio 1 91 FM podcast. You can find more of them at r1.co.nz/podcasts.